Hi, everyone, and welcome to our podcast, Panic and Pandemics. I'm Grace, and we're joined by our hosts, Oscar and Zach, today, and they will be discussing disinformation, distrust, and vaccines. To start us off, where do you think distrust first began when it comes to public health?
If we had the time of a long-form podcast, I would first talk about the complex of past events that reach back deep into human history that created a multivariate and stratified reasons for such a specifically placed distrust. Because we are provided that kind of time, I would just say that in the relative contemporary, that is the last 50 plus years till present, national and in some cases global institutions have proven rather consistently that they are at times incompetent at best and malicious at worst. We, the individuals of society, end up having to deal with the repercussions of their mistakes, rather be by being their test subjects or of their casualties. Well, this can be an entire discussion. It serves as a quick response to your question. That is to say that the cynicism inherent in humans is a reflex that does not need contemporary settings to react. That is internet, social media, and the news outlets. In fact, by looking at the Spanish flu, we can see a striking similarities to how the public reacted then and now, while the set and setting of the two events couldn't be more different.
For those of our listeners who are unfamiliar, could you provide some more background on the Spanish flu?
Yeah, so in regards of the gravity of the Spanish flu, at the time, it's proposed that it had infected about a third of the human population, which was about 500 million during that time. Obviously, our population now is a lot different and has grown by then. But even within that time, there was an estimated 50 million deaths in the world. And, you know, these are estimates that range anywhere from 17 million to 100 million. So this is just only a somewhat agreed upon average. And the reasoning for that is that the tools that they had to measure these deaths and kind of the data they had available is not the same that we have today. So obviously there is a large range and a large margin of error, as you can see. However, we can still understand today that the gravity of the flu really did affect millions of people. We know that for sure. You know, some of the differences between that virus and the COVID virus that we see today is that during the Spanish flu, there was a high death rate among the 15 to 34 age group, which is, you know, was really unexpected because we expect that to be one of our healthier groups since they're more youthful. The life expectancy overall was lowered by 12 years, and it was different than COVID because of the high death rate of the younger age group. So we see with COVID now, it's taken a lot of our more elderly population, but back in that time, it really hit our that age group that was aforementioned. And, you know, the impact of the pandemic on the United States is really sobering to contemplate. During that time, some 670,000 Americans died. And in 1918, medicine had barely become modern. Some scientists still believe miasma accounted for influenza spread. With medicine's advances since then, lay people have really become to really understand and become more complacent about influenza. So back then, you know, if you said somebody had the flu, it meant a death sentence. Whereas, as you see, the contrast now is referring to the COVID as a flu was seen to be, you know, not that big of a deal, not as deadly as people are making it out to seem.
So how was the Spanish flu managed by public health officials? And how would you say that is different or similar to the way people have reacted to COVID-19?
Yeah, so, you know, during the time of the Spanish flu, there was no public health officials established. I was actually the beginning of where public health first began. So really, there was a lot of dependent on governmental officials and the governments in total to push non-pharmaceutical interventions, personal hygiene, disinfectants, isolation and quarantine that we do see today. And, you know, there's a large connection to vaccinations and modern medicine. And today we see the advancement of technology and medicine, which has enabled a multitude of ways of managing the virus, including advanced tracking mechanisms and other things that, you know, they didn't really have access to during that time.
Well, it's 2021 now, and it still seems like the cynicism and distrust continues on. I've heard from many of my friends and colleagues who are Black or Latino that they are worried about this vaccine and specifically distrust the development of it. Why has this attitude persisted for over 100 years?
Well, many of the events that I'm going to speak on are relatively obscure in the public sphere. The damage of them has seeped into the social unconscious. So, for example, not even 50 years ago, there was the Tuskegee trials, which many are familiar with, and there are many who are still unfamiliar, were carried out between the years 1932 and 1972 by the United States Public Health Service and the CDC. And so these two large entities that we're asked to trust now are the same entities that are responsible for this study in which they monitored patients who had syphilis within this community in Alabama without informing them that they did in fact have syphilis and without administering the cure that had already been available for over two decades. So, you know, this type of mistreatment of the Black community there in Alabama was an instance where we could see that the two government entities really took advantage of this community. And despite, you know, all the institutional changes that have come since then, it's very hard to tell a community that you have wronged in such a way to trust you now and, you know, to give your wholehearted trust now. And, you know, the thing is that even though these are specific instances of minority communities being taken advantage of, we know that as a collective, because they are minority communities, they're more wholly affected by these mishaps because word gets around and it's very hard to tell these people to kind of regain the trust from the people. And so this study in particular was kept under wraps for so long until there was a leak actually that let people know that this was going on. So it wasn't even these governmental entities that let the people know. Another example of this is actually Spanish-speaking women in actually our Los Angeles area being unwillingly sterilized in our hospitals here, especially notably the USC hospital. So there were approximately 60,000 people sterilized under U.S. eugenics programs. And, you know, it was the justification that under eugenics, these people were unfit to reproduce, which was really, you know, unjustly purported onto these communities. And because of that, now you had the Black community and the Latino community being unfairly subjected to these types of treatments by these medical entities. And so to try to get them to trust you now, as far as, you know, abiding by public health measures or even taking the vaccine, is very difficult, despite that sentiment no longer being carried. But the damage has already been done and seeped very deeply into these communities.
This seems like a lot to come back from. Those are horribly unjust studies. It sounds like there's a lot of work that needs to be done, and it's going to take a lot of time and effort in order to rebuild that trust with those communities. Building off of what you were saying, though, I also know of some of my mom's friends who are obviously part of a different community. They have young kids, their parents, but they also feel uneasy and skeptical about vaccines in general. How do you think the distrust in this community began?
Yeah, so this is actually reflective of a different demographic that has developed a distrust in vaccinations, more commonly known as anti-vaxxers. And part of their argument stems from a study done in 1998 by Andrew Wakefield. The study was published in The Lancet, a reputable medical journal, and was said to have irrefutable evidence that shows the MMR vaccine, a standard in the West as well as places abroad, caused autism in infants from 0 to 2 years of age. The study was replicated many times by respectable institutions, and all of them came with the same conclusion that Andrew Wakefield's study was absurdly false. It was also found later that he had financial ties to a new vaccine that was to replace the MMR vaccine if his campaign were to succeed. This obvious misuse of his position for financial gain started a campaign to discredit the MMR vaccine with the intention to mislead the public in believing the MMR vaccine that is given to children shortly after birth is hazardous and has the propensity to initiate autism. This was only exacerbated by the media's use of this misinformation.
Yeah, so building off of Zach's point, first of all, there's a correlation of misunderstanding with the rising cases of autism over the past 30 years, which was actually not due to bad vaccines, but good science. So more specifically, this is to say that since 1990, the understanding of the spectrum of autism that we have today has grown since that time. Whereas someone would go undiagnosed 30 years ago, today they are more likely to be diagnosed with autism due to our rise in our understanding. And while this information is good to have within the scientific community, it's poorly communicated and inevitably spun by the media to sensationalize the MMR debate. And, you know, like this study in particular, regardless of the study being recreated multiple times and proving that, in fact, the MMR vaccine did not cause autism, the media continued to run the emotional media stories about parents with children who suffered from autism and circulated this far and wide. So parents just continually saw these stories of these kids suffering from autism and were trying to do some correlation to the vaccine. And despite all the scientific data showing the contrary, which was published in the same exact journal, such as The Lancet and other reputable journals where the initial false study was published, they did not get as much media attention. And so, you know, I think this really speaks to the power of PR over actual scientific data, because it really shows that despite science being solid and showing to the contrary, whatever the media chose to do in this instance really affected parents much more and just people much more than did actual empirical studies. So this really calls into question who can be trusted and where can we get our information from if the media is going to constantly do this and scientific data won't be trusted no matter how concrete it becomes.
You're right. We do need answers on how to properly disseminate information. This would help rebuild society's trust in public health and ensure that individuals have enough information to make the best decisions for themselves. According to this study by the National Center for Biotech Information, 40.9% of people actually don't trust the COVID-19 vaccine. I think this really speaks to the anti-vaxxer movement that you guys were referencing. But overall, it does sound like there's a lot of players involved. So really, in addressing this issue of trust, more specifically to the COVID-19 vaccine, which institution do you guys think we need to hold accountable?
Well, personally, I think scientists have a large role in being responsible for a lot of distrust, as I think they should be more transparent about the metrics of their study. As we saw within the COVID vaccine, there were multiple companies, you know, kind of releasing the results very staggered, and it was more kind of like a race to the finish, more than like a proper dissemination of information. And I think we also saw that some of the distrust was kind of exacerbated as a lot of disadvantaged communities were actually not represented within these trials, which is a common mistake that has been made over vaccine trials again and again, because as we had spoken of earlier, some of the communities less likely to get the vaccine are the communities that they fail to enroll in these studies most of the time.
Well, I agree with you that the scientists have an important role to play when disseminating research information when the research is finished and not prematurely. But I believe it is the media who needs to be held most accountable. They are the shepherds of society. And by this, I mean that they sensationalize or misrepresent something, or when they sensationalize or misrepresent something, the individual who consumes that information becomes uninformed. And because of this, they become an unknowing mouthpiece for disinformation. The media is so consumed with monetary gains, it is in their best interest to act first and apologize later, even if it is to the detriment of the American public. An example of this would be COVID-19 and how it was unofficially dubbed the China flu with the help of the media, where the chances of a person being infected by an ethnically Chinese person, specifically here in America, is almost non-existent. And we could see the same thing happen in the early 1918s with the Spanish flu, where the namesake of the virus has nothing to do with the nature of it.
Yeah, so I get what you're saying about the media taking some accountability. But I think the conversation also revolves back to when we're talking about this role of sensationalization, I think scientists play a large part in that. As I was speaking of earlier, there is this kind of this race to the finish that we saw by a lot of these companies producing the vaccine. And so I think this role of sensationalization really happened because of the monetary incentivization. So, you know, this was, a lot of these companies are publicly traded stocks. So publicizing information, you know, whatever, releasing whatever they have at the moment just to keep their stock up is also a point of sensationalization where I think scientists have to be held more accountable. And I think an example of this is that Moderna got some of their funding from the NIH, but the rest of their money was coming from private investors. So I think the transparency there of, you know, what are their motivations? Why are they, like, you know, the first to finish? Why is there so much money being put into this one company? Really plays a large part in speaking about their lack of transparency. I think, honestly, you know, like, maybe the accountability of scientists is kind of overestimated at points, because I have seen with social media, it's very hard to keep track of all the disinformation on there. And there really is no vetting process besides, you know, adding the links to the CDC or the WHO website. But, you know, if some of the disinformation is targeted directly to discredit those institutions, it's very hard to undo that. So I do get where you're coming from, that, you know, the media really has a large part to play, and not just our news media, but, you know, also these social media sites. They need to be kind of held more accountable, and we need to kind of, especially in situations such as these, and with, you know, a pandemic that's so grave and taking a lot of lives, need to be way more responsible on the type of information that is circulated out there. And so I think this kind of adds to, like, a larger conversation about, you know, if this disinformation can be life-threatening, then there should be some type of form or some type of way that we can have a vetting process and not necessarily just go, you know, censor crazy.
I agree. It's relatively frustrating because when it comes down to it, we have an information system in the form of media that doesn't have checks and balances to push out truthful information or at least validated information. And then once that gets picked up by social media, it's like a wildfire and we're not sure how to control that. And so these are definitely points of contention that we need to, as a society and as a group and as individuals, think about and look at. I totally agree with you, Oscar.
Thank you so much, Oscar and Zach, for giving us some more information on vaccines and disinformation. To our listeners who want more information, especially from sites that are reliable and you can trust, please go look at cdc.gov or who.int to get that information. Again, thank you so much for listening.